You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Ideas Network is bringing you a documentary series about a little-known process with massive consequences. WPR Reports Mapped Out is a deep dive into redistricting and what it has meant for Wisconsin. We bring you the fourth episode now as WPR's Bridget Bowden and Sean Johnson tell the story about a partisan gerrymandering case out of Wisconsin that went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court.
We want to introduce you to a guy named Mark Lanterman. He works in computer forensics.
My job is to analyze digital evidence and give it a voice.
Mark Lanterman has a long resume. He's a former member of the U.S. Secret Service. He worked on the Bernie Madoff investigation, the Martha Stewart investigation, and the investigation of Prince's death.
But the only case that ever impressed my mother was the Paul McCartney divorce.
That's an amazing resume there.
Well, it beats writing parking tickets.
In 2013, Lanterman finds himself working on a new case. He's inspecting some hard drives and he starts finding things. Someone has deleted hundreds of thousands of files.
And one of the hard drives has been damaged. The screws are stripped. The casing is bent. And Lanterman thinks it's been hit with a blunt object, like maybe a hammer.
And hard drives, as you can imagine, are fairly fragile devices. You know, you don't want to throw them out a window or anything like that. And they're not meant to be hit with hammers.
Sounds like another celebrity case, right? Another big name to add to Mark Lanterman's resume.
But this case involves state government in Wisconsin and the hard drives Republicans used to draw the state's political district lines in 2011.
Lanterman gets these hard drives after Mark Miller, the Senate Democratic leader, posted all of those redistricting documents online. That tipped off the lawyers for Democrats that there were documents missing from the stuff they were given at trial.
They flagged this for the court and asked if they could examine the computers, the actual computers Republicans used to draw the maps. And the court said yes.
The Democrats hire Mark Lanterman to examine 9 hard drives. The court doesn't find any wrongdoing with the damaged hard drive or the deleted files. But the documents on the hard drives tell a story.
They show the Republican mapmakers, Joe Hendrick, Tad Ottman, Adam Foltz, started their work with a pretty even map, and they kept drawing maps that got more and more Republican. The file names stood out to Lanterman.
So one was called Current Map, one was called Team Map, one was called Joe Assertive, one was called Tad Aggressive.
The documents showed that under the old map, Republicans could be expected to win 49 seats in the 99-seat assembly.
But as they drew new maps that were more assertive and aggressive, that projection grew to 59 seats, a huge majority.
The documents also showed that Republicans had drawn this map so that this majority could survive even a Democratic wave year, that mapmakers knew what they were doing when they drew these districts.
These documents would become the foundation of a new court case, one that would take on partisan gerrymandering and go all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court.
From WPR Reports, I'm Sean Johnson.
And I'm Bridget Bowden. This is Mapped Out. The case begins well before those redistricting documents came to light, before Mark Lanterman did his investigation. It begins with an idea from a man named Fred Kessler.
Fred Kessler may have a longer history with redistricting than anyone in Wisconsin. He worked on Wisconsin's maps in 1963, in 1971, and 1991.
In 2011, the day the maps passed the Wisconsin Assembly, he's a Democratic state representative from Milwaukee. And this time, he's on the outside looking in.
And in all the years I have been working on redistricting, I have never seen anything as egregious and as outrageous as this.
In his floor speech that day, Kessler references U.S. Supreme Court cases that have raised the prospect that redistricting plans could be too partisan. that a partisan gerrymander could be unconstitutional if it went too far. And Kessler thinks this map has done just that.
And I said, I have organized this committee to challenge the redistricting.
They meet at a place called the Watts Tea Room in downtown Milwaukee. One of the first people invited is Sachin Chetta, then chair of the Democratic Party of Milwaukee County.
So we kind of had a corner to ourselves, and the loud political people could pontificate. And, you know, a lot of it was just talking and thinking. I mean, it was probably...
Kessler brings other people on board, including someone he went to college with in the 1960s, Bill Whitford, a retired law professor from Madison.
We chatted basically about what can be done.
At first, they're just talking about what's even possible out there. If Democrats have no shot at winning the legislature, what can they do? Chetta says they see one path forward.
And we're like, we're going to take a case to the Supreme Court.
The United States Supreme Court, the final arbiter for any federal redistricting lawsuit. They're basically trying to do something that's never been done before. Convince the court that some partisan gerrymanders are too partisan, that they're unconstitutional.
This would be big, because not only would it affect Wisconsin's maps, but the whole country. People in any state could challenge partisan gerrymanders in court.
But this is not an original idea. People have been trying this for decades, and each time they failed.
The Watts Tea Room group knows that if their case is going to be different, they'll need help from experts, political scientists, statisticians, lawyers.
Their team grows. They bring on University of Chicago law professor Nick Stephanopoulos. His girlfriend, attorney Ruth Greenwood, joins the team too. She's an expert in redistricting.
For me, it's a personal sense of wanting this to be a place where this country that I have admired is holding up, you know, principles of democracy.
Stephanopoulos has co-written a law review article about a new metric for measuring partisan gerrymanders. It's called the efficiency gap, and it's central to their case.
The efficiency gap is basically a formula that compares raw vote totals to actual wins in the legislature. It does this by looking at what they call wasted votes.
A political party wastes votes in two ways, by casting too many of them in races that they were going to win anyway, and casting too few in races where they come up just short.
So using Wisconsin as an example, when Democratic voters get packed into a dense urban district that they win in a landslide, they're wasting a lot of votes.
And when they get spread out or cracked so that they come up just short in other districts, the efficiency gap says those votes are also wasted.
And so you are wasting votes on the Democratic side, both in packing and in cracking, while the Republicans are wasting very few votes across the state.
The efficiency gap is a way to put a number on this. The higher the number, the bigger the gerrymander.
And when Wisconsin's election results under the Republican drawn map get plugged into this equation, the number is among the highest in American history.
And for the record, there are other measures that political scientists have used in the past, and they also flag Wisconsin as a gerrymander.
So in Wisconsin, this is quite a different scenario. This is as extreme as they get when it comes to partisan gerrymanders.
So now they feel like their case is really coming together. They have those spreadsheets Mark Lanterman found, the efficiency gap, the experts. But a lawsuit is not a lawsuit without someone to bring it, someone who will put their name on the case, a plaintiff.
The Watts Tea Room group wanted one of its own. They chose Bill Whitford, the retired law professor from Madison.
They file their case in federal court, and then something unexpected happens. They don't immediately lose.
Because remember, partisan gerrymandering cases never go anywhere in federal court. And here they are in a federal court, and these judges are listening.
5 years after Republicans pass this map, it goes to its second trial, this time to determine whether or not it's an unconstitutional partisan gerrymander.
Republicans, the defendants in this case, say there's nothing unconstitutional about redistricting that gives a partisan advantage to one side. Republicans won in 2010, and that gave them the power to draw these maps.
They also argue that Democrats are naturally disadvantaged because of where they live, packed together in cities like Madison and Milwaukee. Because they're not spread out all over the state, it's harder for them to win more seats.
But the court isn't having it. they say Republicans have disproved their own argument. The spreadsheet showed that they drew lots of maps, including some where the partisan advantage wasn't so pronounced. So it's not just where Democrats live.
In a 2-1 opinion, the court sides with the Democrats, finding the Republican map unconstitutional. The ruling is the first of its kind.
The map will stay in place for now as Republicans appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. But the Watts Tea Room Group is one step closer to making that long-shot dream a reality. More on that after the break.
It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our WPR reports mapped out with Bridget Bowden and Sean Johnson.
So when a case like this that could alter American democracy goes to the Supreme Court, it's a big deal.
Everyone wants to weigh in, and they do that by filing amicus briefs, a formal way of telling the court, hey, you didn't ask for this, but we have opinions here.
There are briefs from other states, Tennessee, Texas, Oregon, briefs from political scientists and historians. National leaders weigh in. John McCain files a brief. So does Bob Dole. There's even a brief from the leader of the Human Genome Project.
And in this crowded field of unsolicited opinions, one in particular stands out. It's co-authored by Keith Gaddy, a redistricting consultant who has worked all over the country. Here he is at a University of Missouri forum in 2018.
And I used to tell people walking in, no matter who your devil is in politics, whether you're from the left or the right, I've probably worked with them at some point in time.
What makes Gaddy's brief particularly interesting is that he's not just any consultant. He's one of the consultants Republicans hired to work on Wisconsin's map in 2011.
And I think there are people in Wisconsin who probably would shoot me if they had the opportunity, okay? Because I am the son of a gerrymandered their state, in their opinion. And then there are people on the right who would shoot me because I'm that son of a threw the Republicans under the bus.
Any Republicans who are mad at Gaddy probably had a couple reasons.
For one, he testified in the Whitford case, and he wasn't standoffish at all. He went into detail about how those maps were drawn.
And now, Gaddy has written a brief saying that the U.S. Supreme Court should step in and limit partisan gerrymandering. He's technically not taking a side, but what he's saying is pretty much what Democrats are saying.
Gaddy is warning courts. Left unchecked, partisan gerrymandering fundamentally undermines democracy. Courts have to get involved.
And for the last 15 years, people have been working on an effort to persuade one man in the country, Tony Kennedy.
That's Anthony Kennedy, Justice of the United States Supreme Court.
At this point in time, the Supreme Court is split 5-4 between justices nominated by Republican presidents and justices nominated by Democrats. Kennedy is the last remaining nominee of President Ronald Reagan.
While there are 9 justices, he's the swing vote. Practically speaking, he's the only one who both sides are trying to convince.
For the people trying to overturn Wisconsin's map, people like Fred Kessler, their world revolves around Kennedy.
I thought Anthony Kennedy was our savior.
In past Supreme Court cases, you've had some justices who definitely want to strike down partisan gerrymanders. And you've had others who don't want the court to get involved. And, says Ruth Greenwood, you have Justice Kennedy in the middle, keeping things interesting.
Almost everybody on the court had said something about partisan gerrymandering. And the only person who seemed movable or open to any sort of new idea was Justice Kennedy.
Kennedy wrote an opinion in 2004 hinting that he would be open to striking down a redistricting plan as a partisan gerrymander if only someone would come up with a fair way to measure it. Sachin Chetta says he thinks they have it.
And I was an optimist that the Kennedy invitation was sincere and that we had come up with the best answer anyone could come up with to the question, which is, what is the standard? How do we know when it is a map that's so partisanly gerrymandered that we should do something about it, right?
So the stage is set. 13 years after Kennedy wrote the opinion that left the door open to a partisan gerrymandering lawsuit.
6 years after Republicans passed Wisconsin's legislative map.
And 4 years after the Watts Tea Room Group started meeting to talk about how they might fight that map.
Everyone gets 1 hour to hash it out in front of the court. Just 1 hour.
So when your time is limited and the nation is hanging on your every word, you get right to the point.
You'll hear argument first this morning in case 16-1161, Gill versus Whitford. Mr. Saitlin?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court.
Some of the justices are obviously skeptical of the case, like Chief Justice John Roberts.
The whole point is you're taking these issues away from democracy and you're throwing them into the courts. Pursuant to, and it may be simply my educational background, but I can only describe as sociological gobbledygook.
And Justice Neil Gorsuch.
It reminds me a little bit of my steak rub. I like some turmeric. I like a few other little ingredients, and I'm not going to tell you how much of each.
During arguments, one of the lawyers for Republicans is defending the use of traditional redistricting criteria. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg interrupts her.
What becomes of the precious right to vote when we have that result, when the individual citizen says, I have no choice, I'm in this district, and we know how this district is going to come out? I mean, that's something that the society should be concerned about.
And before you know it, an hour after they began, arguments are over.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted.
About 8 months later, in June of 2018, the Supreme Court issues its decision. And it's not what the Watts Tea Room Group had hoped for. The case is remanded.
It's not a complete loss. The case is still technically alive, but it gets sent back to the lower court because the Supreme Court thinks the Democratic plaintiffs didn't have standing to bring the case.
What does that mean? Essentially, the court says that Democrats haven't presented enough plaintiffs who can prove they were injured by the map.
Like Bill Whitford, the lead plaintiff. He's a Democrat from Madison. He's suing because he wants to overturn the entire map, but the court says he hasn't proven that the map affected his district or his vote.
The ruling means Democrats can bring this case again if they get plaintiffs from around the state.
However, just 9 days later, the bottom drops out.
Anthony Kennedy, the Supreme Court's swing justice, who this entire case was built around, retires.
It's a huge blow to the Democrats' case. Even if they rebuild this case and bring it back to the court with more plaintiffs, Kennedy, the justice who kept the door open, will be gone.
Then 1 year to the day after Anthony Kennedy announces his retirement, the Supreme Court issues a ruling in another partisan gerrymandering lawsuit, this one from voters in North Carolina and Maryland.
In a 5-4 decision, the court decides that they're not going to do anything about cases like these.
It closes the door that Anthony Kennedy opened. The court's not saying that partisan gerrymandering doesn't exist. It's just saying that federal courts won't fix it. Looking back at that day in the Supreme Court with the benefit of hindsight, there's a moment that's pretty revealing.
Justice Sonia Sotomayor has issues with the way these maps were drawn. Misha Saitlin, the attorney arguing for Wisconsin Republicans, says the map drawers followed those traditional redistricting criteria.
But they kept going back to fix the map to make it more gerrymandered. That's undisputed. The people involved in the process had traditional maps that complied with traditional criteria, and then went back and threw out those maps and created more, some that were more partisan.
That's correct, Your Honor, and of course there were computers.
So why didn't they take one of the earlier maps?
Because there was no constitutional requirement that they do so. They complied with all state law, and they complied with all traditional districting principles.
Can I take you back to...
So Justice Sotomayor points out how the maps were drawn, that they kept getting more and more partisan. And Misha Saitlin, the lawyer for Republicans, says...
That's correct, Your Honor.
That's correct.
And then Justice Sotomayor asks, why didn't Republicans pass one of the earlier maps that was less partisan? And the lawyer for Republicans says...
Because there was no constitutional requirement that they do so.
There was no constitutional requirement that they do.
This, in a nutshell, is redistricting law. It's where we were when this case was heard, and it's where we are today.
The map in Wisconsin still stands. It's been in place for nearly a decade now. What that's meant for Wisconsin, next week on Mapped Out.
Mapped Out is reported by Bridget Bowden
and Sean Johnson. We're produced by Brad Kohlberg, edited by Noah Ovshinsky. Music by Carl Christensen. Additional support from Adam Friedrich.
Digital editing by John K. Wilson and digital direction by David Hyland.
Photography by Angela Major. Artwork by John Nichols.
You can see more at WPR.org/mappedout.
And next week on WPR Reports Mapped Out, it's a look at what Wisconsin's 2011 district map has meant for policy in our state. Ahead this hour, we learn how the city of Eau Claire is addressing PFAS contamination and find out what your community is doing. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. Good morning. You're joining us for the morning show. I'm Kedar Chirkent. In northern Wisconsin, loggers who have been in the industry for decades say they're experiencing one of the worst markets they've seen. Paper mill closures have led to a huge drop in timber prices that's now lasted for more than a year. As Rob Menser reports, this is threatening the livelihoods of many forest professionals.
There's a wall of hardwood stacked up here at Dennis Shenick's northern Wisconsin logging site. The mechanized arm of the harvester measures and cuts the timber. Haulers will take it to paper mills, which will turn it into pulp. There are still mills that buy this wood, but loggers like Shenick say these are some of the hardest times his industry has seen.
You know, the mills are full. They're flush. And they know it. And they know there's more power, horsepower out here to produce wood than what they need. So they can literally set our price.
Prices crashed in mid-2020 after the Ohio-based company Verso announced it would stop production at its massive Wisconsin Rapids paper mill. That mill was the region's largest buyer. Without it, there's a glut of pulpwood on the market, driving prices down. It's also driving some loggers out of the business.
There's guys dropping out now. For me, I even wonder, it's like, do we keep wearing this equipment out just to make our payments?
He's talking about payments on heavy equipment like the harvester. Like all loggers, Shenick has been scrambling to cut costs and control his losses.
There's no profit anymore. The profit is gone. Like always, we keep getting kicked down the road, you know, and we keep trying to survive. That's the nature of our beast.
Logging, hauling, and forestry employ some 64,000 people in Wisconsin. And for many, it's a family tradition spanning generations. The Northwoods relies on logging to make forests usable for recreation and to help protect them from invasive species and fires. Now, some loggers are quitting. Some have taken side jobs in construction. The rest are holding out hope that the Verso Mill will reopen one day soon.
It's not just the local community of Wisconsin Rapids. It's not just the people that work in that mill, but the ripple effect is enormous.
That's Rebecca Ludke. She's the director of the Wisconsin County Forests Association. She says some Northwoods counties rely on revenues from forest management to fund public services. About 20% of the wood Verso bought came from county forests.
When you take 20% of the wood completely out of the picture, there's going to be a gap, right, that needs to be filled.
Last year, a loggers group formed a nonprofit cooperative with the goal of buying and operating the Verso Mill. The idea had enthusiastic support within the timber industry and among politicians from both parties. But according to people involved in discussions, Verso itself was always lukewarm to it. This summer, an attempt to boost the cooperative with $65 million in state loans failed after Democrats and Republicans couldn't agree on how to pay for it. Industry analysts say it might not have made a difference anyway. Verso's share price today is well above where it was before the pandemic. Paul Fowler is director of the Wisconsin Institute for Sustainable Technology. He says he expects that the Wisconsin Rapids Mill will eventually sell, but Verso has no particular incentive to hurry.
Aside from how it looks to the communities in which they've operated and idled mills, they're probably sitting in a good position.
But that position leaves the Wisconsin timber industry and the communities that rely on it hanging in the balance. Henry Schinnebeck is the director of the Great Lakes Timber Professionals Association.
To them, it's just a line on a piece of paper. But for us, it's not just a line on a piece of paper. It's everybody's life.
In July, a private equity firm that operates several paper mills offered to buy Verso. Late last month, Verso told shareholders that deal was only possible if the firm, quote, meaningfully increased its offer. For loggers like Schenick, that means more waiting. And the longer the Wisconsin Rapids mill sits idle, the more lasting the effects will be. Rob Menser, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And now to PFAS contamination. The DNR has identified more than 50 sites in Wisconsin with these human-made forever chemicals in the environment. The city of Eau Claire earlier this month shut down almost half of its city wells due to PFAS concerns. What should the state and local communities do next to contain the PFAS pollution problem in drinking water? Are you drinking bottled water due to PFAS? It's 800-642-1234, a line for you. Lane Berg is the Eau Claire Utilities Manager. Lane, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. Explain the situation with your wells and the readings you're seeing.
Okay. So we, in July of this year, we identified some wells that were higher in PFAS levels. So we shut those wells down voluntarily, just as a precaution. One thing that I want to point out is, you know, City of Eau Claire water is safe and always has been. Even when we first discovered this issue, our levels were below DNR recommended enforcement standards.
So
we shut down the wells out of precaution. We did notice once we shut those wells down that the PFAS plume migrated towards a few of our other wells. So, and we didn't actually shut down anything last week as was reported. That was actually done back in the end of July and early August. So
okay.
We haven't done any clarifying. Yeah, yep, exactly. And that created some panic last week, but that was totally unnecessary. We've been doing some steps to, you know, try and help the situation, and those steps appear to be paying off. So we did install some piping in our well field, and we shaped two existing lagoons that we have, and so we were able to start dumping water from our higher level PFAS wells into those lagoons, or absorption ponds as they're now called. They've been retitled because they serve a different purpose, and we've actually seen our PFAS numbers in five of our wells go down, and our entry point sample has went down significantly. So the entry point sample is where the water leaves our water plant and goes out into the system. So that's really the most important number that we look at, is what, you know, what the entry point is, because that's what customers are receiving from us.
Yeah. So explain to us then, how many wells of concern are there at this point?
Yep. So we initially shut down four wells, and then we shut down an additional three, you know, like I said, back in late July, early August. So, you know, and as I mentioned, we are seeing numbers improving on five of our wells, and the entry point is improving. So, you know, things are looking better, but, you know, dumping into the absorption ponds is a temporary fix. We're probably going to have to do something else, but we'll know more after we work with our engineering firm that we're working with right now.
Yeah, how long can the city go on dumping contaminated water into these holding ponds?
Yep, so we're working with the DNR. This is a temporary fix, as we agreed to. You know, that's not a permanent solution for us. So we're thankful the DNR allowed us to do that. But the one thing to remember is that, you know, we're dumping that water on the ground, and it is soaking into the ground. But the important thing to remember is the PFAS is already in the ground. We're just removing it very short term and putting it back on the ground. The goal of dumping into our absorption ponds is to keep the PFAS plume from spreading to our good wells. And our absorption ponds are in a location where they should not impact our good wells. So that's why the DNR has allowed us to do this.
You've been Eau Claire's utility superintendent, or the utility manager, for a quarter century now. Have you been in the situation before with dumping water?
No. This is a new one for us. So we've always been, you know, very blessed to have an abundant supply of water, and we've never dealt with an issue exactly like this. Many years ago, there was an issue at our water plant with VOCs from industry. And so they had to construct a stripping tower to deal with that. But this is a new one for me that preceded my tenure with the city of Eau Claire.
So over the decades then, when did PFAS first come on your radar? And when did you first see it as a potential threat to public health?
Sure. So we actually did some proactive sampling back in 2020. And we analyzed our results. And we just took an entry point sample, what's going into our system. And our numbers were below the DNR recommended enforcement standards, so we felt pretty good. We did detect PFAS in our water, but it was at levels that are very low. And then we did another round of sampling in 2021 here. And we met with the DNR on July 1st of 2021, and they introduced something new to us. The Department of Health Services developed a new hazard index, and it's a guidance tool that helps deal with PFAS. And they analyzed our numbers, and according to this new guidance tool, they suggested maybe we should look at our individual wells, and so we did. Then we sampled all of our wells, and that helped us to discover that we had four of the wells that were slightly higher in PFAS levels than the rest of them. So The new hazard index is actually a valuable tool. It helped us to identify that we do have some wells that are higher than others. So, as a proactive measure, our goal is to keep our PFAS levels as low as possible. And so we shut those four wells off immediately. And now we're looking at options of how we proceed from here.
Yeah, and we're going to look long term here in a moment. But in the meantime, how is this affecting water distribution to homes and businesses and schools?
Yeah, so we're actually doing really well. We have a tremendous amount of wells in our well field. And so we were able to keep up with production, through our busy months through July, August, September. Those are typically our higher pumping months, and we were able to keep up with that, producing safe water, and we kept up with the demand. So we had no watering bans or anything. So we did really good this year. Now pumping has slowed down quite a bit. So we're doing very well right now. We will know, very soon. We're going to meet with our engineering firm. That'll help us determine how we go from here. We're discussing different options for us. Do we drill new wells in locations not affected by PFAS? Do we install treatment systems? And we're going to lean on our engineering firms to help us determine the best path for the city of Eau Claire.
We have Eau Claire Utilities Manager Lane Berg explaining the PFAS situation there and the water supply next steps for his city working with an engineering firm. Are you worried about your exposure to PFAS and confused about what is a safe level? Is your community doing enough to address forever chemicals? Did you install a water filtration system or do you rely on bottled water? Still time for you, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Lane Berg here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing the PFAS problem in Wisconsin, what Eau Claire is doing about forever chemicals that it sees in its city wells. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. As far back as the 1940s, scientists developed a class of chemicals that are used in a wide range of products. Think food packaging, nonstick cookware, some cosmetics, paints, varnishes, sealants. The list goes on. The DNR has identified dozens of PFAS contamination sites around the state. Are you worried about your drinking water? Has your well been tested? Is your municipal water system exceeding safe levels for PFAS? How did you learn this? 800-642-1234. Lane Berg is Eau Claire's utilities manager with us for about 9 more minutes. So, Lane, looking at sources of this pollution, the DNR had directed the Chippewa Valley Airport to investigate its use of firefighting foam at the airport. That order came in August, I believe. Do you know the status of that investigation?
Yeah, I don't know a ton about that. The DNR is actually handling the investigation portion of this, so I know they identified them as a PRP or potentially responsible party, But we're letting the DNR handle that portion for us. We don't need to deal with that. So they're doing a great job in working with the airport to determine if it was a source from them or if it's somewhere else. So, yep, we'll let the DNR handle that portion of it for us.
But what do you think? Do you think the airport is a source of the PFAS well contamination?
Yeah, like I said, I'm going to allow the DNR to work on that. I don't know for sure. So I would just hate to speculate.
In terms of speculating, though, what could other suspected sources be for the rising levels of PFAS in your wells?
Yeah, so, you know, as you mentioned, it's been used in so many products and whatnot over the years, nonstick cookware, firefighting foam, clothing, you know, water repellent clothing. You know, PFAS compounds, they have a unique trait of repelling both oil and water, so they're, you know, obviously the value to that for nonstick clothing and cookware and whatnot is endless. But, you know, as we've learned about many other things over the years, maybe they're not so good for our health. So it could be from a number of sources. We'll look to the DNR to narrow that down for us.
Explain for us working with an engineering firm and what you might be able to do to remedy this long term or to contain this problem in a long term fix, if there is a fix for forever chemicals. What have you been advised to do?
Yeah, so we're working with Gannett Fleming right now, and they're doing some groundwater modeling for us, and we're hoping that they can identify the limits of the plume, you know, how long we'll be dealing with it, the direction it's flowing, and then they'll also be able to predict what happens when we run certain wells in combination. And, you know, we're really going to look to their guidance to help us get through this. So many things depend on, you know, what this groundwater modeling study tells us, and that'll determine the direction that we go. You know, some of the initial things we've looked at is drilling additional wells in areas not affected by PFAS. There are treatment systems that treat PFAS up in Woodbury, Minnesota. They've installed a treatment system recently that uses a media. I believe they use activated carbon, but there are also systems that use resins, and that's a possible option. So, you know, but we're really going to lean on Gannett Fleming to guide us in the right direction and, you know, help us pick the best choice for our situation.
What about cost? How would Eau Claire pay for the best solution here?
Yep, we're working on that right now. We'll meet with our finance team and discuss what our options are. So, you know, there is quite a bit of talk about federal funding for PFAS. We did meet with Representative Jody Emerson and Senator Jeff Smith this week, and they toured our water plant and they looked at our absorption ponds. And so they're going to go back to the state level and see if there's any funding being discussed at that level. So we're optimistic that, you know, there may be some funds that assist with this. I think as you will see, this is a bigger widespread issue than just Eau Claire or some of the other places that have been mentioned. I think as time goes on here, you're going to see this affecting a large portion of the state. So I hope that, you know, we treat this the same way we've been doing with lead services. We have a very aggressive lead service replacement program, thanks to DNR funding. So, you know, we're without that, we might not be able to make that happen. So we're optimistic that, you know, PFAS will follow the same path and hopefully get some funding for us to deal with it. If we don't get funding, we'll deal with it. This is something that we have to take care of, and we will.
We're talking with Lane Berg, who manages Eau Claire Utilities, as we discuss how the city is addressing PFAS concerns following the recent shutdown of some city wells. You can join in. Do you live in Eau Claire? What do you think of the city and its approach to PFAS? What should the state do to address PFAS in our groundwater? 800-642-1234. Lane, you know, along those lines, that you're not alone in this. Eau Claire is not alone in this PFAS problem. Contamination, a huge problem in Peshtigo, French Island, other communities around the state. Are you in contact with other utilities managers and other communities to figure out solutions and what others are doing?
Yeah, we've talked to other officials that are dealing with the problem. We've We've done a lot of research. We're kind of fortunate that we were not the first one to deal with this. So we've done our research and saw how others dealt with it. And we're trying to, you know, not take the path that, you know, some of them did. It's difficult when you're the first one dealing with an issue. So we're trying to avoid, you know, some things that bog us down. But we were able to get a lot of things accomplished in a very short amount of time. You know, because of that, we used other best practices, and, you know, we're really fortunate in the city here. We have some excellent city staff, and we have support of our higher ranking officials. So, you know, we're fortunate. Everybody is supportive, and, you know, we've got a good brain trust here to deal with it and, you know, do what's right for the city of Eau Claire.
And speaking of the SWIFT timeline that you're on, when will the modeling study be complete?
Yeah, we've actually talked to Gannett Fleming, and they've proposed a meeting for next week to go over their preliminary findings. So, So things are progressing very nicely. You know, we hope within a month we'll have, you know, much, much better direction, and then we'll start progressing towards a solution for this. So, you know, we're discussing, you know, do we prepare for drilling wells? You know, do we, and we've already met with people that install treatment systems. So we're looking at things. We're going to fast track whatever it is that we need to do.
Well, broadening out to look at the federal level here, the Biden administration announced this week it's going to move to set enforceable drinking water limits on PFAS. And once the mandatory standards go into effect, which, you know, will take years, local water utilities like Eau Claire could face penalties if, you know, you fail to meet them. How do you feel about enforceable federal compliance standards to approach the PFAS contamination?
Yeah, it's, you know, as a utility, it's difficult. You know, we're dealing with something that we had no control over. So, I feel everybody's pain. You know, there's other municipalities that are dealing with the same thing. You know, we didn't put the PFAS in the ground. We're just unfortunately stuck dealing with it. So, you know, I'd certainly like to see a lot of effort put into funding, you know, to deal with this instead of penalizing people. But that's just my personal opinion.
Yeah. So how should the federal government, the EPA specifically, help communities like Eau Claire address this public health problem?
Well, certainly our DNR and DHS have been really good to work with. They've presented things. They introduced this new hazard index. So, you know, for government agencies to work with municipalities in a partnership, that's the best approach. We're thankful that the DNR has worked with us and the DHS. You know, the hazard index that was recently developed, that helped us to identify our the highest level wells that we have. So that, you know, we are thankful for that. I'd much rather see government agencies working in a partnership as opposed to, you know, discussing penalties and whatnot. You know, we're stuck in a tough situation as a municipality dealing with something that we did not put in the ground.
Lane, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, you're welcome. It was very nice to talk to you this morning.
You too. Lane Berg, Eau Claire Utilities Manager. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.